Yep. Thanks, Dave. It's been a very, very interesting set of talks. So thank you very much, David and Jennifer, for inviting me and being involved. It's, I've been learning quite a lot. And I'm glad to start off the morning here with some historical perspectives. And I thought I'd use one of my favorite slides I often use at the end of my talk, pointing out the value of history. This is from one of the vodka commercials, of course, I'm sure you've seen. And I also often use, near the end of my talk, a couple of quotes, one of my favorite quotes. This is one of them from Mark Twain. History never repeats itself, but it does tend to rhyme. And I like this particularly because it captures this sort of duality of Earth systems, the recognition that there are indeed processes that repeat themselves. And you know, as scientists, we tend to focus on those because we want predictability. We want to identify patterns that are repeatable, that are predictable, that we can write equations for and have some confidence that they'll be correct. But at the same time, there's history laid upon these repeatable processes. There's contingency and stochasticity and unpredictable nature of history. And these things overlay each other. One of my favorite sets of essays is on this topic is by Stephen Jay Gould. He has a set of actually lectures I think he gave somewhere that he put together in a book called Time's Arrow, Time's Cycle. And he talks about this duality of you know, understanding the origins and history of life and the history of geology and biology is just intertwined with this recognition that there are these, there are these repeatable patterns that we can identify that we can use to understand. But at the same time, there's these contingencies. And he goes through this, you know, talking about, well, if you were to, you know, rewind the movie of life and, you know, think of it as a cinema movie and rewind it to the beginning. And even though it might still be operating on the same principles and the same processes, because of the contingencies of history, that the movie would be different every time you rewound it and played it forward again. So this is, I think, really important to keep in mind when we think about pyrogeography and trying to develop predictive models, is that there will always be the aspect of contingency and history. And this other quote is also, I think, becoming more one of my more favorite ones as well. And both these guys, of course, were these authors, these novelists, great American men of letters. We're talking, I'm sure, about societies and human cultural history primarily, but it's striking to me how I think there's some relevance in both of these ideas. The past is not dead. In fact, it's not even past. And this is, I think, is coming to the fore in my mind recently, especially with the discussion about historical range of variability and whether or not we can really use the past. And Is the past off the table now? I've actually heard that in some meetings recently. Ron Nielsen actually said that. He said, "Oh, we got a HRV. We got to take that off the table. It's no longer relevant. We're in a completely changed world now. Invasive species, climate change, people. Forget the past. We got to just, you know, figure out where we're going into the future." And there is truth in that. No analog. We are facing no analog situations, so we must know the dynamics and the mechanisms to move forward. But still, this does not discount the value of history and using history to understand where we got to in the first place. And the contingencies of the past, the legacies of the past, are still highly relevant to understanding where we are now and where we're going to in the future. And for other reasons, like knowing whether or not indeed things have changed. How do we know that we're in a no analog situation? unless we study the past. All right, a little bit of advocacy and preaching there. Some of the topics I want to cover today, and I've got too many slides, so we'll see if I can actually get through all of these in a reasonable time. I'm focusing down, and it's a finer scale, I think, than what we've been hearing and talking about in recent last couple of days. I'm not going to go global, I think, with maybe a couple of exceptions. I'm talking about ocean atmosphere, teleconnections. I'm really focused using the Western United States and the Southwest as a case example of here of using history and tree rings for looking at fine scale patterns, starting at the landscape scales, and understanding how physical landscape controls and human controls at fine scales from stands to landscapes are controlling their fire regimes. And then human history the importance of livestock raising and the profound changes in surface fire regimes in large parts of the western United States and eastern United States as well. And then I'm going to talk about what we've learned using interannual to decadal scale high-resolution tree ring records. We're looking at ocean atmosphere dynamics, particularly ENSO, but also the other oscillations, PDO and AMO, have come into play recently in looking at fire patterns in the West. And then last, just touching on lightning and people and this fascinating interplay of humans on these landscapes over long time scales, especially places where, in this focus, on this talk, places where lightning is so ubiquitous. How can we disentangle the influence of people versus lightning as causes of fire regime patterns? All right, fire scars. I'm sure most of you are familiar, maybe some of you are not, with this general idea or this general phenomenon that surface fire regimes, where you've got frequent low severity fires running through the understory of conifer forests, usually don't kill most of the overstory. They burn through the understory with flame lengths, 1 meter or less in height, and you get wounds created at the bases of these trees, particularly when you get fuel accumulations. A branch falls at the base of that tree and the surface fire burns intensely up against the base of that tree, and so you get a wound formed. And the wound is it's killed tissue underneath the bark. The bark sloughs off, and then you have exposed wood and pitch and resin oozing out of the wound boundaries so that subsequent fires ignite very readily on these surfaces. So it doesn't always take a high intensity or high severity fire to create subsequent scarring. The first scarring event might be relatively high, but after that, these trees become really good recorders. And we find very commonly in pine forests around the West scars that look like this. They're lesions that come into the tree rings. And subsequent overlapping ring growth. And of course, by counting the rings and dating the tree rings, we can date these exactly. And commonly, we find right in the mountains here in Southern California, on the top of the mountains, the montane zones, trees with 10 scars, 20 scars on a single tree, going back hundreds of years.
Sorry, I can't see how you can count the rings if the tree is,
Well, this would be the bark.
But in this case.
Yeah, this is the bark, and the rings are too fine here to see on this magnification, but we can see the rings are actually clearly distinguishable. It's possible to count from a known bark date, and also using tree ring dating techniques, we can date dead trees. We can cross-date the patterns of wide and narrow rings, and thereby sample logs and stumps and remnant material from long past. We have no idea when it died, but we can date the wood and then see the lesions coming into the rings. And we can date them to the year and often to the season, the relative season, so that we can see where the wound comes into an annual ring and tell whether it's during the dormant season or during the growing season, the early part or the later part of the growing season. Mostly, these are restricted to surface fire regime types. Obviously, if you have crown fires that blow out the canopy and kill the trees, you have no fire scar record. So there is some bias in these records, primarily to the surface fire regime types. Although fire historians throughout the West and elsewhere are now pushing into mixed conifer and spruce and fir and getting more fire history records from both fire scars and age structures of forest communities. But I want to talk mainly about the fire history from surface fire regimes. And one of the advantages of this high resolution record that has very spatially explicit locations of samples, you can collect trees at different and aggregate them at different spatial scales. So you can work from the stand level and sample multiple trees in a stand, maybe over 10 hectares, over 100 hectares. You might sample 20 or 30 fire scarred trees. And you can work your way up to watershed scales and sampling multiple watersheds and developing chronologies of fire occurrence at each of these points in space. And you can work your way on up to, landscape scales and even regional scales. And the value of the tree ring dating here is that it's accurate to the year. So it's possible to identify synchrony, patterns of synchrony, with high temporal and spatial resolution. And, being able to work at these multiple scales enables you to basically begin to sort out the different causal agents and different patterns of driving the temporal and spatial changes. So at the fine spatial scales of single trees and stands, You know, you might maybe able to study the dynamics of fire severity and its effect on recruitment dynamics of trees. And, you know, at these scales, you might look at the effects of topography and slope and aspect and elevation. And as you work your way up to larger and larger spatial scales, you begin to be able to pull out these broader top-down sort of influences, climate in particular, in the patterns of synchrony. So I'm going to illustrate here briefly, very briefly. This is just one example, sort of a landscape scale study. One of my PhD students just completed, he sampled these two contrasting landscapes in southern Arizona. This is ponderosa pine and mixed conifer forest. He has this study area here, and the little triangles are plots where he's sampled multiple fire-scarred trees within each of those triangle plots. And he's got a chronology of fire occurrence at each one of those triangle locations. So we look at the intervals between fires, and we can look at the fire frequencies in these two landscapes. And they're contrasting in terms of their aspect and slope. This is a south-facing, rather gentle slope. This is a north-facing, rather steep slope. You see the gray areas here are 35 degrees and steeper slopes, and that's primarily north-facing. This is primarily ponderosa pine, a little bit of mixed conifer with Douglas fir. This is primarily Douglas fir with a little bit of ponderosa pine. And here's just comparing the elevations are very similar between the two study areas, but there's striking contrast in the slope classes. This is frequency distributions of slope classes, frequency distribution of aspect classes, okay? And then when you look at the intervals, the fire intervals, the distribution of fire intervals in those two sites, they are also quite different. And this is something that is increasingly being shown in the Western U.S. Alan Taylor, Tony Caprio, other people working in these high-frequency surface fire regimes showing rather striking slope aspect class differences on fire frequencies. Mind you, these are all relatively short intervals. We're talking, you know, the south-facing slope aspects with less than 10 years typically, north-facing steep aspects a little bit typically more than 11 years, but still relatively frequent intervals. There are even more striking differences in places in the West. You know, you can go from a south-facing frequent fire regime of 2 to 3 intervals on grass, montane grasslands, and at the north-facing aspect, you can switch into spruce fir, where there's no fire scars whatsoever. And it's a stand replacing fire regime, and it's there are forests that haven't burned for hundreds of years. Yeah. Yes, I think so. I think so. Yeah, indeed. These tend to be grassier slopes. And an interesting question there as to what's driving it. Is it the dryness? Is it fire that's actually maintaining more open stands? I think there's some really interesting interactions there between the herbaceous and then the fuel dynamics from the trees and the leaves and the trees. Another example of a rather fine scale analyses that are being increasingly done with fire scars is looking at elevational gradients and looking at fire frequencies along elevational gradients. And we have a set of these transects, elevational transects on the west slope of the Sierras, and there's been recent work on this and on the east side of the Sierras by Alan Taylor and throughout the Great Basin by Emily Heyerdahl and Peter Brown. And typically, you know, we're seeing, you know, some generalities of elevational controls on fire frequencies. So that and mind you, these are moving primarily through surface fire regimes from pine, oak woodlands, on up to wet mixed conifer forests, okay? And you see the range of intervals, mean intervals between surface fires, 5 year or so to 10 year kind of intervals at the lower elevations and running up to 25, 30 year intervals at the higher, wetter end. But there is some pattern and some repeatability here. And my point is that, you know, a biogeography or a geography of fire is going to need to consider some of these fine scale patterns as well. Yes? good question. I'm going to get to that, I think, maybe toward the end. I think combination of humans and lightning. Now, I'm going to jump to big scale, where we start to see humans and climate really affecting fire regimes. And this has been facilitated in recent years, especially by the development of networks of fire history sites. And Colin showed, for example, this really big global network of charcoal series. And that is a really big step forward, is that finally pyro historians are getting their data together and putting them in data networks and compiling them and looking at patterns over increasingly large scales. And this is international multi-proxy paleofire database is one of these efforts. So far, the fire scar tree ring records are primarily North and South America. There's some from quite a few developing from Scandinavia, almost none from Asia, and we hope that Australia will flower with, and New Zealand, Tasmania maybe will eventually see more fire chronologies from other areas around the planet. But the networks are increasingly being analyzed by people in the climate and human history context. And these are just a couple examples of spatial networks that have been recently analyzed. Emily Heyerdahl's Pacific Northwest Network, and Peter Brown has this transect from the Black Hills down through New Mexico. And then Tom Veblen and his work in the Central Rockies and the Colorado Front Ranges, for example. Each of these points, mind you, are collections where you've got fire-scarred trees, usually 10 to 50 fire-scarred trees, and the tree rings and scars are dated, and you have chronologies. And they're chronologies of fire events, so you know the dates of when fires occurred in these locations, and sometimes some more specific information within those sites of what was going on. And then an example of Thomas Kitzberger's and Veblen's work down in Patagonia, Argentina. Our network from the Southwest, the Four Corners region, is probably the most extensive. Currently about 120 sites from ponderosa pine and mixed conifer in this two-state region. And increasing numbers of them also in Utah. This is starting to fill in up here and in Colorado as well. Okay, and here's, this illustrates as an example of the ubiquity of fire in these places. This is a chart that shows the occurrences of fire among 63, about half of those sites from the southwestern United States. And the time series goes back to 1600. And the horizontal white lines are composite fire chronologies from individual stands. And the tick marks, the yellow and red tick marks, are the fire dates in those stands. And primarily, you're looking at fires that are relatively widespread. These are filtered so that the red and tick marks are, red and yellow tick marks are fires that are recorded only by 10% or more of the trees within the stand. So they're relatively widespread fires within these stands. And the red tick marks are color coded here as the fire years that are synchronous, broadly synchronous across the 63 sites. And you can see that down here in the number of sites recording fires per year back to 1600. And there's this remarkable degree of synchronicity. Now, so for example, 1748, typically about two-thirds of all the sites we sample in the Southwest pick up this one fire year. And the odds of that are astronomically low. Given the frequencies of fire within individual sites, you would not see that by chance. One chance in billions to see that kind of degree of synchrony. And there's a high degree of synchrony overall. There's some apparent drop-off back here, which may be a sample depth issue. One of the problems of tree rings is a fading record. The dashed lines here are periods of time before any fire scar has been recorded. There are tree rings in those stands, but there's no fire scars recorded. So you get a dropping off of the sample depth. The other thing that's very clear, I use this graph because it just shows how striking the change, the 20th century change has been in these landscapes across the West. Ubiquity of fire, typically one or two fires per decade in most of these pine-dominated forests, and then a century of much less fire occurrence. In most stands, a few places, a few unusual places where fires continue to the middle part of the century. These are isolated forests out in the middle of lava flows that they didn't bother to go put fires out there because they were so isolated. And this is in Mexico. And we see this in an increasing number of fire chronologies from Mexico. In remote mountains of Mexico, there's no effective fire suppression and no strong livestock grazing. And so you see continued burning. But here's, you know, you can see this absence of fire because of livestock. And this is one of the patterns that's really profound in the Southwest and more or less repeated in many places across the Western U.S. where there were large numbers of grazing animals, particularly sheep. They brought in sheep before the turn of the century and up until the First War. Sheep was huge in the West. The big industry. You know, look at the numbers here. In New Mexico, by 1890, there were 6 million livestock. That's like two orders of magnitude or three more than people in these places. And they were moving bands of, you know, 50,000 sheep up and down a single mountain range. And these sheep would move up and down seasonally, and they would create huge trailways, and they would graze them very intensively in the meadows. And what we see is that these fire frequencies decline almost to within 5 years or so of when the first sheep are introduced historically. There's a little bit of variation from one stand to another, you'll see here, and that those variations are closely coupled with the advent of livestock. So the removal of fine fuels. Yes?
Paul, given what you heard yesterday, the scaling rules that the stick fires are inevitable, you effectively say that the ecosystem, there was a bifurcation of the
ecosystem. Yeah. In these frequent surface fire regime types, where grass understories were really important in fire spread, and livestock was a big thing in the early decades of settlement, we see this cessation and a really big shift. And there are consequences to that, obviously, with fuels and structure. Just another point about the profundity, if you will, of this change. We see it in the last 300 years. It's a profound shift. Recently, with charcoal studies, this is an example from Craig Allen's work and Scott Anderson in a bog, taking core samples from this wet bog surrounded by mixed conifer forest where we have fire-scarred trees. So a sediment core taken there, and then these are the locations of fire-scarred trees and aspen, ages of aspen trees, all in a watershed feeding into that bog. And we see fire scar history here. These are individual trees with fire scar dates, and they're highly synchronous. And there's the 20th century decline in lack of fires after the late 1800s and the fire scar record. And here's the charcoal record going back about 7,000 years. And this period at the top, the last 20 centimeters or so, is devoid of charcoal. And that's the only period in that 7,000-year bog record that is devoid of charcoal. Yeah, well, this is an interesting question about maybe some of the lack of charcoal record in the global records or other patterns. To what extent is this livestock effect, the settlement effect in the West, reflected in those records? It's unusual. At least in these sites in the Southwest and parts of the West, it's unusual. We see similar patterns. Here's the Sierra Nevada network of sites, Yosemite and Sequoia. Transect studies, and the same kind of thing. Frequent fires, highly synchronous, sudden drop-off, and virtually no fire scars recorded through the 20th century. Okay, and it drops off a little bit earlier in the Sierras. There's fewer synchronous fires through the 1860s and 70s, which also seems to correspond with the beginning of livestock grazing in the 1860s, 1870s in the Sierras. That's right. That comes a little bit later. I mean, the Smokey the Bear, the U.S. Forest Service really takes off after they get organized in the early 1900s, and they really pick up firefighting as their mission in life after 1910. And arguably, they really didn't have the wherewithal until the 1930s with the Civilian Conservation Corps and large numbers of people and manpower and building of trails and lookout towers. And after the Second World War, they had firefighting aircraft and so on. So the fire suppression, the livestock grazing drops off after the First World War, but then active fire suppression by government agencies begins to take that role after the early 1900s. That's right, exactly right. I mean, this is an issue. I mean, and it's there's a correspondence in many of these places with the, I mean, the Native American people were removed so they could do livestock grazing. In the Southwest, the Apache people were subjugated and removed from these landscapes, and, you know, that's when the livestock grazing began. So there is some confounding of that issue. Right. Connectivity. Yep. Good point. Okay. Again, I'm just showing other examples of where the declines. My point here is that this has occurred elsewhere in the Western United States. This is from Oregon. This is Emily Heyerdahl's data sets from Oregon and Washington. And you see, this would be the solid line is the fire occurrence, is from fire scar record. And she actually has it calibrated to area burned for her study areas. And then the light colored line is precipitation, showing a pretty good match between decadal patterns of precipitation and fire activity. But I'm showing this here specifically for this drop-off and lack of fire scars as well that occurs in east side of Washington, Oregon. Same thing has been seen in Utah, Nevada, Montana, places where there were livestock grazing and there were surface fire regimes disrupted in the late 1900s. So this map, I'm sure some of you are familiar with it. It's flawed in quite a few ways, but still it's probably useful as a really general kind of a picture of where fire regimes may have occurred and some of the diversity and variability of fire regimes across the United States. And particularly what I'm talking about here, the high-frequency surface fire regimes are primarily this sort of light-colored blue type right here, where we're talking, you know, 1 to 35-year fire frequencies of low severity, and probably some into some of the green. The green coloration here is coded as 0 to 35-year fire frequency with some stand replacement severity, and then the yellow is 35 to 100-year frequency mixed severity. So there's some kind of overlap between these fire frequencies of surface fire regimes into mixed severity fire regimes. My point here is that talking about the changes that haven't occurred in some places, like the Yellowstone moment up here, when we recognize that large, high severity crown fires are probably not unnatural and not outside historical range of variability in these high elevation spruce fir, lodgepole pine types. And those are the red. I mean, primarily these red types are the places where we think there were really long intervals. And so fire suppression, livestock grazing has likely had much less or even no effect in those places. The places where these land use effects have had more profound influences are in the lighter blue here. And note that large parts of the eastern United States, especially the southeast, with pine-dominated landscapes, formerly pine-dominated landscapes, used to burn extremely frequently as well and have had the big changes with the forest transitions there. Okay, and the impacts, I mean, this is sort of the caricature of ponderosa pine changes that's been over-extrapolated across the West, but nevertheless is a general pattern in many of these landscapes I just pointed to. Ponderosa pine, clear open understories. This is 1909. You can see hundreds of meters through the trees, some grass in the understory, but a lot of pine needle, and the surface fires were running through here. We know, actually, this stand in Flagstaff, we have fire frequencies here of 2-3 year intervals between fires for centuries. And then livestock grazing, fire suppression, wet period in the early 19-teens, trees established, 1949, same view, and then 1990, the ingrowth of these thickets in the understory. So we have many examples where we've sampled fire-scarred trees in stands like this, where that are choked with small diameter trees that are less than 100 years old, and there's fire scars on these trees showing fires every other year for 300 years until 1900. And this is repeated over and over, especially in the Southwest, but it's also not uncommon in other parts of the inland West. I mean, you can find places like this in Montana, in the great parts of the Great Basin, the west slope of the Colorado Rockies, the east slope of the Sierra Nevada. There are other places where this has been ingrown. And it's not entirely fire suppression. There's been logging and then lack of subsequent thinning of these stands that have encouraged tree growth. The livestock grazing itself, probably promoted the ingrowth of some of these trees. And there's extreme fire behavior in these places. I mean, fire managers and firefighters have been just astounded at the severity of these fires, like the Rodeo Chetiskai fire. There, this area of the Rodeo Chetiskai fire burned something. A story I heard was on the order of about 15,000 hectares burned within about 30 minutes in this area. Rolling fire whirls, horizontally rolling fire whirls, with enormous pyrocumulus clouds punching up through the troposphere. So extraordinary fire behavior in some of these kinds of pine thickets. Nevertheless, there is evidence in these landscapes that some degree of treatments can have an effect. Not always, but in some cases. These are examples of places. These are false color images, of course, of the burned area. And these greens are actually areas that did not burn or burned with light surface fire. And they were, these two areas in particular, were either thinned or prescribed fire burned within 10 years before the event. There's some interesting areas over here that had some earlier thinning and fire and prescribed treatments that had less effectiveness in terms of limiting the fire spread. My point about this, we've been talking the last couple of days about how, well, you know, big fires are going to happen. There's nothing we can do about it. And indeed, I mean, in the case of chaparral and lodgepole pine and spruce fir forest, where stand replacing fires are the norm, and that's the kind of fire regimes that those systems are adapted to and will burn as in the future. These landscapes where surface fires were a more predominant feature, that, you know, there is increasing body of evidence that some treatments can be effective. And so there's a lot of discussion about how to do these treatments. What are the strategic ways? Yes. How much this was related to the logging versus... Yeah. I know there is a report, Peter Morrison and others have done a report on suggesting that this is, and it's not all just because of lack of surface fire, that logging generated surface fuels and so on. And I don't know what the mixture is there. I would agree, though, with that point that it's not just fire suppression, it's not just dog hair thickets from fire suppression, that the logging activities opened up these forests and maybe dried them out, but then also generated fuels, some heavy fuels with the leaved remains in these areas. Maybe. There's some of that effect too. Yeah. Okay. One of the uncertainties, I think, about crown fires, as we move up elevation, especially the mixed conifer and the mixed, so-called mixed severity fire regimes. And this is where there's a relatively lively debate out there among fire ecologists and fire managers about crown fires and, you know, the extent to which crown fires might have occurred in ponderosa pine forests. Is I think there's a blurring. People are blurring this division, the understanding and recognition that mixed conifer forests did indeed have some crown fire. And in fact, I would say ponderosa pine, pure ponderosa pine, had some crown fire. The issue, though, is the scale and the extent of the fire patches. And to date, despite, you know, the papers that are arguing that crown fire was, you know, really important in, for example, the Front Ranges of Colorado, I have yet to see really good quantitative evidence of the size distribution of these crown fire patches that are being reconstructed. People are picking up evidences of crown fire from fire-killed trees or age structures of trees in these stands, but they're being done on really tiny little plots, and there really isn't the systematic work done necessary yet to really map out the size distribution of past crown fire in these forests to know really whether or not we're seeing big changes. Now, I got to go faster because I want to hit the climate angle and point out some of the findings from the network analyses, the really broad scale network analyses of climate and fire. And one of the point that leads into this is that one of the stimuli for this the sort of flowering of fire climatology, if you will, from tree rings is the advent of these networked reconstructions of Palmer drought severity indices, for example, the Cook et al. Network across North America. We can go to each of these grid points and download a time series It goes back at least to 1700 AD, and in some cases in the West back more than 1,000 years, and get, you know, pretty good quality reconstructions of drought severity. And in addition, there's a whole set of other publications in recent years using tree rings to reconstruct all these oscillatory patterns. So there's El Nino reconstructions, there's Southern Oscillation Index reconstructions, there's Palmer Drought, there's Pacific Decadal Oscillation and Atlantic Multi-Decadal Oscillation reconstructions from tree rings. And these provide this sort of independent basis for the fire scar studies. So what you're seeing now is the people doing fire history with fire scars and tree rings are building these chronologies in these networks of fire histories, and they're then using the tree ring reconstructions of drought and oscillatory behaviors to analyze the fire-climate interactions. And this is just a small segment of the papers in the last, well, actually this only runs from about 2003 to 2005. And so I would say the numbers of papers are two or three times this now, looking at fire-climate interactions in the western U.S. And one of the more interesting developments in fire history in the last few years is this use of regression techniques reconstructing fire history from tree ring width chronologies. And so Martin Girardin and his colleagues in Canada are using this approach. Tony Westerling and I have tried this. Basically, the idea is you take modern fire occurrence data, would be the dashed line. Okay, this is area burned for western Canada or eastern Canada or all of Canada. And then he takes tree ring width chronologies, climate-sensitive tree ring chronologies from Canada, and he's calibrating a model during the period of overlap and then using the regression model and the tree rings to estimate area burned back in multiple centuries before the present. So he's using ring width chronologies to estimate area burned. And one of the cool things we have an opportunity to do here in the western U.S. especially is use fire scar records as another independent variable. Okay, so we've got ring width chronologies, which are developed from other drought-sensitive trees, measured ring width series, and then we've got fire scar chronologies. So it's possible to develop calibrated fire scar area burned comparisons in this period, and then use the fire scars use the ring width chronologies to go farther back in time. Chris Rose, I think, may be highlighting an example of this from the Southwest that he and I are working on. Just wanted to note that we've got a special issue that came out just in February with there's about 10 papers in this special issue on fire climatology. I think Phil Dennison's got a paper in there and a number of folks. It's a combination of charcoal studies and climate and tree ring fire scar studies and climate in this special issue. Okay, I'm going to wrap up here in just a few minutes. But I want to say something about the use of these fire scar records, an example for looking at interannual patterns. This is the Southwestern network again. This was 120 sites going back to 1600. You see this high degree of synchrony. This is the same graph, but I'm showing here the low fire occurrence years down here, so it's plotted downward. So you see these are the years when very few sites recorded fires. You see the effect of livestock grazing and fire suppression here after the 1900. These dashed lines I use as sort of thresholds for identifying the highly synchronous large fire years and the highly synchronous small fire years. And when we compare that with the Palmer drought severity reconstructions from the ring width chronologies, you can see that, you know, there's a remarkable degree of matching between the large fire year events shown in red and the negative PDSI years, and generally speaking, the small fire years and the positive PDSI values. So it's actually, this is a really, you know, showing the high fidelity of both the fire scar record, the regional fire scar record, and the regional drought reconstructions. The thing that we see in these records repeatedly across the West, especially in the pine-dominated forests, is that these big regional fire years that are hitting on dry years are very commonly associated with a wet year, either 1 to 3 years before, and a small fire event, a small regional small fire year. So there's this kind of switching, this wet-dry switching And we can see this in a superposed epoch analysis, where you're looking at the average PDSI during the big fire years, and then you see this wet surge in 1 to 3 years before, typically. And these are confidence intervals from bootstrap. So basically, this is the common pattern, especially in the Southwest and lower elevation pine forests across the West. Interestingly, as you go to the higher elevations in the mixed conifer, the prior year lags drop out. And basically you get a more significant dry year during those mixed conifer, but not a significant lag. Pointing again, I think, to the herbaceous component, that this is very likely the rapid response of grass fuels, maybe some tree needle production. We've shown this repeatedly in the paleo record, and in subsequent years, it's been shown in the modern record. And so Tony Westerling has looked at this over the western U.S. for the 20th century. He's looking at area burned records and numbers of fires and grid cells. So he's gridded out the numbers of fires and the area burned in these grid cells. And he's taken PDSI values and gridded them out in the same grid cells and computed correlations. So what you see is that in the prior year, prior season, correlations are positive. These are the significant 0.05 level correlations, the one with little white dots in them. And these are the correlations scale here. So basically, positive correlations in prior seasons, prior years, especially in the Great Basin and the Southwest. So it's when it's wet, when it's positive PDSI value, 1 or 2 years before, or 1 or 2 seasons before, you have high fire activity. And then during the fire year, you have negative correlations. And they're using this pattern. Actually, the predictive services folks up at NIFC, the National Interagency Fire Center, are using some of these lag models now in some predictive tools for looking at seasonal outlooks of fire occurrence. The other thing that we're seeing and other folks are seeing across the West with these network studies is the importance of spatial patterns and the controls of these the teleconnections of ENSO and PDO. This is a work that Thomas Keatsberger and the group of us pulled together 238 fire histories from throughout the West with some very big holes in them that we have to fill in, actually, with new sites and with more sites. But still, with this sort of preliminary analysis of it, we found some remarkable patterns that are reflective of climate and pointing to the spatial controls of climate. This is then taking the PDSI network, the tree ring PDSI network, and running correlation analysis versus the fire scar chronologies that are shown here in black. These are the typical patterns with the first principal component. You get this very strong dipole pattern of the Southwest being in an inverse pattern with the Northwest. And that mirrors a pretty well-known ENSO teleconnection and precipitation dipole that occurs across the West. And that is typically when it's wet in the Northwest, it's dry in the Southwest and vice versa. And usually El Niños, during strong El Niños, this pattern is really strongly manifest. During El Niños, it's going to be wet down here and dry up here and vice versa during La Niñas. And I'm not going to go into the details, but this paper, this PNES paper we did, shows that this is significantly correlated with the Southern Oscillation, independent Southern Oscillation records. And this pattern is much more reflective of the PDO, the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, where the Pacific Northwest is strongly coupled in a positive way with the PDO. One of the points about this is that I think is really critical for pyrogeography is that these spatial patterns matter. They matter to climate and they matter to fire. And we've learned more and more how the ENSO and the PDO and now the AMO and the NAO and all the EIOs influence these spatial temporal patterns around the planet. They are important teleconnections that explain some amount of variance, in some places a significant amount of variance of the climate system. The AMO is a really interesting one that's been discussed a lot recently. This paper shows that, for example, during the AMO positive phase, you have wider spread droughts. This is the typical 1930s Dust Bowl drought occurred during a positive AMO phase. And this is more like the 1950s drought pattern. And what we find in our PNS paper is that the positive AMO phase matches very well with when you have the most fire and the most synchronous fire occurring across the western United States. So again, the point here is that understanding these dipole patterns and what causes them and how they drive fire, I think, are going to be critical for a complete pyrogeography. Implications of some of these decadal patterns are that, you know, they propagate through the system in various ways. And this is, I think, is really a classic paper published just a couple, few years ago by Peter Brown and Ross Wu. And what they did here is they combined a tree ring reconstruction of the Southern Oscillation Index with fire scar history records with demography, with ponderosa pine and Douglas fir demography. This is ponderosa pine. These are ages of the frequency distribution of tree ages in ponderosa pine, and this is a distribution of Douglas fir. And notice their fire scar record shows these interesting decadal gaps, which is another thing showing up in many of the fire scar records, is that you get these frequent fires, you know, once or twice per decade, and then you'll go 20 or 30 years without a fire in some of the sites. And they're corresponding pretty nicely with pulses in regeneration, as you might expect. So there's this really interesting dynamic of interannual decadal scale fluctuations controlling demographic patterns in these forests. And then, you know, you can imagine what this is having probably some influence on fire dynamics, fire behavior subsequently, if you generate thickets of trees during some of these pulses. We see this last couple of points here. The Giant Sequoia was a unique case of where we were able to get really long fire scar records. They had really beautiful fire scars that go back more than 3,000 years. And we were able to compile records from five different sequoia groves going back with pretty good sample depth the last 1,500 years. And what we see is that the black line here, the red line is the fire history or the frequency of fire events among five sequoia groves on the west slope of the Sierras. And the black line is a temperature estimate from these foxtail pines that are just growing right up slope from the giant sequoia. So these are growing at tree line, and the ringlets here are highly correlated with growing season temperatures. The bottom line here is that, you know, there's some degree of correlation, a significant correlation, interdecadal and centennial correlation between the temperatures and the fire frequency. In particular, this medieval period, this medieval drought period, is getting more and more interesting. And it's really a lot of the paleoclimate folks in the West, both the observers and the modelers, are very interested in this medieval drought episode showing up really strikingly in the tree ring drought reconstruction. So this is the PDSI, the proportion of the area of the western U.S. affected by drought, as indicated by hundreds and hundreds of tree ring sites calibrated with instrumental records. And notice, this period, compared to the 20th century, this is the 20th century here, and this is the recent drought, this little blip right here. So the point is that, you know, natural variability, non-greenhouse gas driven, anthropogenic greenhouse driven variability in the West is huge. And this comes back to the HRV issue. I mean, I think we're really relatively quick to say, oh, we're outside of HRV with climate in the West. Not necessarily. I mean, there's potential analogs here, at least partial analogs, for some of the changes that we're seeing with extraordinary droughts that we have yet to see. This is the absolutely last major point, is lightning is a really critical aspect in the West. And if you have a chance, take a look at that paper. I included the Allen et al. Chapter. Lots of lightning and plenty of people. And it's just amazing the amount of lightning on some of these landscapes. This is 1 year. Look at the scale. This is about this is about 750,000 hectares. Okay, so this is in northern New Mexico. This is a chunk of landscape in northern New Mexico of about 750,000 hectares. 1 year of lightning occurrence data. All those little black dots are lightning strikes. Now, you know, some small proportion of them would have started fires, but there's a huge number of fire events. And, you know, the lightning data is getting better. The data sets are getting better with the lightning detection network, and So it's possible to map out. And although on this one, on 1 year's data, you don't see any, there's no real clear spatial clustering over years. This is about a 10 years worth of data set. There is clustering. This is a mountain range right east of Tucson, Arizona. This is in Saguaro National Park. And these reddish areas here are the highest frequencies. We're talking about 3 strikes per square kilometer per year as a maximum. There's a lot of lightning. And, I mean, if you think about in the past when fires would start and there's nobody putting them out and there's no livestock, literally fires can start in April or May in southern Arizona and burn until September or October. So the potential for fire spread over long distances is very high. It really doesn't take that many ignitions. So the point here is that there's just a heck of a lot of lightning. Lightning is ubiquitous. So what could be the role of people in these landscapes? Still, despite this, I'm becoming more convinced through some of Chris's work and others that indeed people did have an effect. We do see this in some of our fire scar records. We see hints that people changed the seasonality of fire, for example. We see some indication that the timing of fires shifts seasonally when we see people. And we also see some historical patterns. You know, when there are peacetime periods, there's less fire than when there's wartime periods, for example. And there's a huge potential, I think, for studying this in the western United States and maybe the southeast too, because people were living right in the middle of these environments. These sites I just showed you, these are huge townhouse sites in northern New Mexico with thousands of rooms. Like this site was around 2,000 rooms, about 4 stories. Think Taos Pueblo, about 4 times bigger than Taos Pueblo. And it's right in the middle of a ponderosa pine forest. And they were living there for centuries. They were living there for hundreds of years. So how in the world did they live in this environment? I suspect they were actually reducing fire frequencies nearby. These are fairly high. It's about 8,000 feet elevation. They had to be fuel wood gathering big time, which would have reduced fire frequencies locally. But still, it's embedded in a huge landscape of ponderosa pine. So these people were living with smoke probably almost every year. How did they do that? Well, we have another number of opportunities to study this, I think, with the archaeology and with the tree ring records that are in these places, and I think Chris is going to talk about that a little bit. So, just concluding, the first point was that, you know, we have quite a bit of knowledge about the fine-scale aspects of fire regimes, and I think there's a potential for doing some fine-scale modeling with some of this new knowledge that's coming in about slope and aspect and elevation. Ocean-atmosphere teleconnections, I think, are really important in some places, and that's a need, I think, for a complete geography of fire. Some past climatic episodes may offer particularly useful analogs or partial analogs. The medieval period in particular is, I think, one of considerable interest in the last couple thousand years. And we have a lot to do to learn more about how native peoples interacted with fire on these landscapes. And I think we can learn a great deal from places where you can still talk to people and learn from them about how they've interacted with fire. Thanks.
Yeah. Janet.
Yeah.
This is terrible. I mean, some of these species really seem like they would have co-evolved with fire, and they would produce something that simply
wouldn't burn. Right.
You have this interesting type of feedback.
Yeah. There's some kind of a trade-off there with pines in particular. Pines tend to be highly resinous. And, you know, besides promoting fire and actually promoting repeated fire scarring, the resin actually serves to seal off the wounds. So when you take a section, for example, a fire scar section from a tree, you'll see that the resin area, the heartwood area, expands to basically close off the wound. And so the resins actually they're water resistant and fungal resistant properties. So there's some kind of a trade-off there with resinous characteristics, which help, I think, you know, trees have wounds and survive, versus actually promoting promoting rewounding and flammability with the resin themselves. So it's a curious kind of double-edged sword there. Yes. Yes. That's been a question that's been asked. Is it possible to tell from the location of the scar on the tree whether there's a prevailing wind? So people have not been successful doing this because I think there's many other factors that determine where the scar is formed on the tree. So for example, trees that are on slopes, on a steep slope, the fuels will accumulate on the upslope side of the tree. And so you get more of a heat effect on that upslope side of the tree that has nothing to do with wind direction. It has to do with fuel accumulation. Just the direction of fire spread, I think, is highly variable, too. So the answer to your question, no, as far as I know, no one's been successful using the orientation of fire scars on tree boles to identify prevailing wind directions.
Tom, isn't one of the most alarming points of your talk that there's certainty that all fire ecologists are working in non-analog conditions because of this late 19th century transition?
I think in the case of these frequent surface fire regime forests, where intervals are less than 50 years, indeed, I think we do need to be very cautious about using the 20th century, 21st century record of fire occurrence patterns to interpret geography, fire geography, and those types in particular, because we know that there's been a major disruption of the pattern.